Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome back. For those of you who listened to part one of this podcast, you'll know that we're about to pick up the second part now. Thank you for listening. Well, let me pick up on that piece on the unmanned environment. We've seen examples in the media of unmanned air, unmanned on the water. I don't know. I haven't seen much of subsurface stuff, but I've certainly seen surface unmanned.
Yeah.
This seems to have been a thread that's come through very loud and clear on this conflict. The pervasiveness, to use Sean's word, of the unmanned vehicle. I imagine if I were a Ukrainian commander, or indeed a Russian commander, in a very difficult, transparent environment, knowing what's going on and where to put people and how to hide them is part of the reason why we've moved into this unmanned realm. But what's your view, James, starting with you? I'll come to you in just a second, Devon. How much of this do you think is pivotal? If we're going to look back in a 5 or 10 year period, will we look back and say, it was Ukraine where the unmanned world, perhaps driven by AI, became the center of our universe militarily?
I think it probably will be. I think if we look at the beginning of the war, the concept of the UAV, the unmanned air vehicle, was very much the same as we have in the West. So Ukraine acquired Bayraktars, which are very similar to things that Turkey is a NATO country, so yeah, clearly NATO countries use. Quite a large, quite an expensive, bespoke military drone. And they started buying, particularly Mavic and... I've forgotten the name of the Chinese company that makes a lot of these.
DJI.
DJI, of course, yeah. Drones for $1,000, $2,000. And modifying them using 3D printing to build components so they could just drop grenades. Very, very simple, very cheap. A lot of these are doing one-way trips. Apparently, if you get 30 trips out of one of these, that's very good going. They tend to be shot down by both sides because both sides are buying the same commercial drones. And so when they see one coming over, they, unless they're the one controlling it, they don't know if it's a friendly or not. So they'll take it down if they can. But this is killing huge numbers of troops. It's forcing them to disperse. If you force troops to disperse, it's difficult for them to then launch offensive operations because you do really need to concentrate to do that. The usage is huge. So at the beginning of the year, President Zelensky said that Ukraine was going to build, I think it was 1 million UAVs. And that really acknowledges the rate at which they're expending them.
Yeah.
And currently, I wouldn't want to guess how many UAVs the British Army has, but I would have, of that sort of measure, of that sort of size, I'm going to guess it's two figures rather than three. Mm-hmm. It's less than the Ukrainians would use in a morning. That's going to change.
Yeah.
And to some degree, it has. The junior BREC and the course in which the British Army trains its corporals, section commanders, now incorporates a drone training phase,
right,
on the expectation that those individuals will operate drones.
First thing. So then, what about yourself? In terms of the unmanned fight that's ongoing and we've seen so much of, how much do you think this is an indicator of a change in modern warfare?
I do think that this is an indicator of change, that unmanned warfare is pivotal, or will be pivotal, but this is very nascent at this stage. I remember back in Bosnia, we got, as just a infantryman there, we got our first look at images from the Reaper, the Predator drone, back then unarmed, back in, the images were a little grainy, but the massification of the UAV, that putting them in mass and delivering them to at a tactical level to just normal troops on the ground is very impressive, and it's going to change a lot of things. Now, what exactly it changes, I don't think it's going to necessarily bring an end to armored warfare, because an FPV drone may be very effective in certain cases, maybe only in 5% of cases, because, that's really, the images we see, the video we see is really the successes, not the myriad of failures. But it may be that that FPV drone can take out a tank, but it's very hard for a drone operator to fly that drone if they're under artillery fire. You know, and this is, you know, it's so on paper that FPV operator and that team is going to be able to take out that tank. But people thought the same thing about anti-tank guided missiles in the early days, that it's just going to take three guys in a trench or three men in a Jeep, and they were going to take out the tanks, not realizing that when you take that off paper and you put them on the front line, that they're dealing with a lot of friction, that they're under fire, that they're scared, that they're, you know, and that that is still going to have a quite an impact. So exactly what happens, we're going to have a lot of lessons to learn. And there's the electromagnetic problem as well, you know, that all of these drones need signals. And this is forcing the drone operators to come closer and closer to the front line, puts them in the danger zone a little bit more. It's going to make it harder to operate.
Fascinating. Sean, I'm going to come to you in just a second in terms of the strategic implications of all this that we're learning from this conversation and before. What does that mean in terms of preparation for the next conflict? Before I do that, let me come back to yourself, James, and Dylan, in terms of, so look through what you've learned over the last 2 or 3 years and all that we saw building up, and now look forward into your crystal ball and tell me where this is going. What do we think the conflict will look like if indeed it continues, if we're sitting here in 2 years' time?
Well, I just go back into the UAS point.
Absolutely, yeah. Go ahead.
So the flip side of this, of course, is the counter UAS fight. And Dylan was saying, of course, these things at the moment need a radio link to the operator.
Yeah.
So the obvious way to defeat these is to jam that frequency. And it, actually, if people are buying commercial drones, that's relatively easy because you can look at Amazon and see what the frequency band is. But actually, this has proven to be quite difficult. There's a lot of equipment on the market. There's a lot of these drone guns shaped like small arms. Feedback from theatre is that some of these do seem to work. A lot of them don't. A lot of them are pretty ineffective or have very short ranges, and therefore they're not that great. Wide area jamming, where you just smash everything working in those frequencies, is a lot more effective. But of course, it just shuts down those frequencies. Yeah. And if you're all trying to fly drones, that's a problem. Yeah. One of the most effective things I'm told by some guys who are on the front line or have been on the front line recently was just shotguns, you know, treating the DJI drones like clay pigeons, essentially. There will be a breakthrough on this. I saw some video of a Russian tank which had, I think it was 30 different jammers attached to it to try and hit all of the different frequencies that drones were currently working on. That's not a particularly effective way of doing business, and it's a big power drain. This is one of the challenges of fitting 228 suites to tanks and armored vehicles at the moment, is just that they're not generating enough power. Mm. But upgrades to tanks, Challenger 3, whatever the upgrade is on Abrams, or the next upgrade of Abrams, there will be a more powerful engine, there will be more power, there will be more defensive A suites. I think Dylan wants to cut in here as well.
Yeah, Dylan, go.
Sure. James, you had some good points, and I want to re-stress them really. What it brings up are two things, and one is the importance of innovation. Mm. The tempo at which signals are being recognized and blocked is 2 weeks to 3 months, and that means you need to constantly have your IT team coming up with solutions to the blocking of these signals. I think whatever side innovates faster is going to have the advantage. Mm. The other thing is, you know, on the blocking of these signals, you know, this is maybe dwelling into where all of this is going at a high theoretical level. But if we can assume that ultimately an EW signal will be blocked, I think that's a safe assumption, you know, and the solution to that, the logical solution is to make these entirely autonomous, that they are not linked back to the man or the woman on the battlefield, that they are able to operate without that link, just like a soldier could on the front line. They don't need that link. They will continue to shoot at the enemy properly as long as they're trained to do so, even if they're cut off from their command. We need the UAVs to do the same thing. And that's dangerous. That's scary for a lot of people, but that may be where this is heading when we put together the effectiveness of the UAVs, but the danger of having an electromagnetic link.
Yeah, I feel, Sean, I feel the AI ethics and kill chain discussions we've had in previous podcasts coming forward into this for sure. But I'm not disagreeing with the logic, right? The logic is self-apparent. You cannot control these things because the EW spectrum is increasingly constrained. You need them because you can't operate, you can't disperse enough, et cetera. Eventually, the logic will determine. And by the way, it's interesting how quickly ethics can get dropped as survival becomes a higher and higher priority. Existential threats tend to drive different kinds of ethics in the history of mankind. But I'm not proposing it. I'm just saying it's a reality that we may have to contend with. And by the way, our potential adversaries may not have the same ethics and concerns about the use of AI in kill chains, but may well be controlling the electromagnetic spectrum. So thank you. That's a useful reverse back into a point that we didn't finish off and come forward again. So let's go back. I'm going to ask you to get your crystal ball out. No, you're not getting away from that.
Right. Okay.
While Sean continues to think about the strategic implications. So, James, your crystal ball now. You're looking into it to see where this conflict is going. What are your thoughts?
I don't think we've seen much change in 2024. I think we'll see Ukraine push the Russians back up to the border in the Kharkiv area, because they're already doing that. I think we'll see the Russians continuing to push in the Donbass, where we're already seeing that. That line will stabilize at some point. I think we'll go into winter with the lines pretty much where they are now, fundamentally. I don't think we'll see any, we certainly won't see any great tracts of land of strategic significance changing hands this year, which will leave both sides looking at what they're going to do in the spring. Now, the defensive, Russia's defenses have just got stronger. I'm told that in some places the minefields are now 300 meters deep. Python, the explosive hose, which is used to clear, is I think 25 meters long. So you're needing 12 to get through that. That's a huge operation, and you want to put two lines next to each other. This is an exceptionally difficult obstacle to clear, and I think one of the reasons why Ukraine didn't succeed in exploiting the breakthrough they achieved last year was probably because they were already dispersed and they just didn't have what we practice for, what troops practice for, which is to have your reserve on your shoulder ready to launch through the gap that you created.
Yeah.
No, they're several kilometers away in an electromagnetic environment which is congested and which is jammed, waiting for an order with their own troops dispersed. So if that's the case, is Ukraine going to try and do the same thing again? I doubt it. I think they'd be very foolish unless they can fundamentally change how they're going to fight this battle. And therefore, I would not expect them to try and achieve a breakthrough of those defensive lines in the same way. Are they going to try and do something spectacular, like an amphibious or an airborne operation? But they don't have the air assets to do an airborne operation. I'm not convinced they have the assets to really do an amphibious operation either. I think we may see this going static with a straightforward war of attrition. I can't see how either side can really deliver that knockout blow. Yeah. Or punch through the enemy lines.
So staggering towards stalemate is what I think you're saying. Dylan, what's your thoughts?
I think in the short term, I expect attrition. There's going to be high attrition with men and metal will continue. And there, I agree, there's not going to be a breakthrough in the short term. The conditions haven't been met for a breakthrough. There needs to be attrition for a breakthrough. It's just that, when the U.S. fights a war, that attrition takes place with a 30-day bombing campaign or similar. But in this case, that's not a luxury that the Ukrainians have. So short-term, attrition, and no breakthroughs. The medium term, I'm going to be bold and say that I think we're going to see a bit of an air campaign because it's the only option. When F-16s arrive, that they may indeed be able to change the battlefield temporarily, because remember, the enemy is always responding. The adversary is always responding. So there will be that brief moment where F-16s equipped with the right weapons and with the right intelligence may be able to move the front and achieve a breakthrough in a selected area. So I'm going to, in the medium term, that's looking at 2025, an air campaign seeing activity in the air. I think that's what we're going to see in the long term. Biases aside, I think Russia will lose. And I think that the reason this will happen is because ideology to an extent is dictating strategy, and they are morally entrapped to pursue this war to an absolute end. They're morally entrapped by their actions in Bucha, by their actions in Mariupol. And that means that they can't lose, because then they'll be held accountable. So they have no freedom to compromise. And that means they have to take over all of Ukraine in order to, and that's just a too hard of a task. So they're going to exhaust themselves, throwing themselves forward again and again, until eventually they'll collapse. Then that's, yeah, that's the long term, as I see it.
Maybe that's where the mothers of Russia start to wield their weight, because they're a mighty force in the Russian culture. Sure. I can't believe we got this far without you saying, wait a second.
Yeah, time precludes everything I'm going to say, actually, but I'll quite try and keep it brief. But thankfully, I actually slightly disagree for a change. So I've been saying since week four that, you know, we're going to end up in a stalemate and a frozen conflict. That is going to remain in terms of tactical activity, in my view, until there's a political settlement, which there will have to be at some stage, whether that is, and it probably will be, frozen conflicts, and we are where we are, give or take 10 miles, whatever. In terms of what does this mean for, you know, if I was a military strategic planner right now, this is a huge headache for the West, if you like. And we haven't really talked about what the Russians have learned, which may be another podcast for another day, because, you know, the enemy has a boat and they are learning quite rapidly. But if it, you know, if it was me in a planning cell working about the next war or the next but one, I mean, that's the first thing to say is don't fight the last war. And I think this has been a signatory reminder that not all wars are the same. It's not all on desert areas. You know, the terrain matters. It really matters. The weather matters. And, you know, there are some aspects of this that go all the way back to the First World War that, you know, are we having to relearn possibly? So the debates that will come out and are coming out now, and people speak passionately on both sides, are, you know, has the capital equipment now had its day, the tanks, the aircraft, and all the rest of it? But, you know, the dominance of those versus the asymmetric, if you want to call it that, the, I know we'd get into drone discussion, UAVs and man pads, all that sort of stuff, where, you know, you can do things quickly at not much cost for disproportionate advantage, and both things can be true. So there will be those that are arguing for, we need more tanks. We really need more tanks and artillery, et cetera, et cetera. And there'll be those that go, no, we were right in, again, the UK side, the Strategic Defence Review, in terms of it's about the technology, you know, it's about that agility and information dominance. Both things can be and are true. The problem is how deep are your pockets? Yeah. So that's the other thing, is that, so in terms of that strategic, you know, big pictures stuff, and nothing really changes in many respects. So firstly, sustainability. What wins wars is sustainability. Can you keep it going? Now, I think what we've found wanting is our ability to sustain even things like artillery shells. You know, having to get that industry back up and running again to support, you know, Ukrainian effort and getting onto a military industrial war footing, which if we don't, it doesn't matter what your tactics are, you're not going to succeed. I think the moral component still comes out. I talk about that a lot. You know, one of the big reasons that Ukraine are still in the fight, and, you know, you've got to hand it to them, is that moral component. They do not want to get beaten by the Russians. They don't want to be, you know, overtaken by Russia. And that matters a lot. And we can't forget that element, actually. I agree with what was said. The electronic environment, electronic warfare, whether that's ECM, ESM, whatever, is really, really important. It always has been. But I think this has brought that back to a fore. And of course, with that comes the whole AI thing. And we won't get into that discussion about the ethics. But, you know, autonomous AI absolutely has got to be the way ahead, but it's only one part of the way ahead, because, again, the human in the loop, at what stage does that happen? Because if you lose control of the autonomous AI, who knows what's going to come back to hurt you? So it's trying to cohere the modern with the traditional and understand the environment you're in. It's incredibly complicated.
Sure. All right, James, well, look, time is now against us. We've been on the record button now for a while. I want to try and bring a couple of insights out from each of us in terms of, for the audience, what is the one lesson, what's the one thing out of this that you'd really let us go away with? While you're turning some cogs on that, I'm going to give you the one that I am coming up with. And Sean, I'll get you next, giving our guests the maximum time to come up with their own preferred one-liner. For me, it's that word you used earlier, Dylan, and I hope it's not the one you were going to choose, which is transparency. The transparency of the battlefield is, for me, the one thing you've said that really stands out for me as a lesson, that it's not just transparency now through various means. It's also the fact that there is so much social media coming out of it. There is transparency in the information domain, for me, is just as important as the military ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance capabilities. You put those together, and almost nothing's happening now on the battlefield that we're not seeing in almost near real time. So for me, the transparency word is a key thing I've taken away. Sure.
That's good, because it would have been obviously what I'd choose. But actually, this is one thing I was going to consider anyway. When you are planning for future capability, all the rest of it, you've got to plan for every eventuality. So you can't just prepare for one particular type of operation. You know, we were beholden to the whole counter-terrorist thing for probably too long, and we forgot about traditional warfare. But you've got to do both. Now, that takes a huge amount of investment and will. And getting that into support from the public is also very demanding. So there's an information piece to that as well.
For sure. James?
I think, as we noted, every war is different. We don't want to be fighting the last war, but actually the fundamentals remain true. There were various attempts to innovate during this war. The Russian Battalion Tactical Group was one, which actually, in retrospect, you should have realised wasn't a great idea. It's actually almost a brigade's worth of equipment to a battle group headquarters. And then they're struggling to function. You know, don't innovate without attempting to reinvent the wheel. And if you're doing something that is completely radical and completely new, ask yourself why no one has done it before. It's possible that you're the greatest military genius in history. It's also possible you're wrong.
I love it. Dylan, final word.
I was going to say transparency as well, but for the sake of saying something different, maybe the second most common word that we've said in this podcast has been attrition. And you know what comes from that is the ability to regenerate force using your industrial capacity and your human resources. It just the cost of war, you know, and that's partially as a result of that transparency, the immense cost that it's going to take to actually wage a war. And maybe that's a good thing, because otherwise we'd wage a war more flippantly. But we have to remember these costs both in men and women, and these costs in material, the industrial capacity that we need to have ready in order to actually wage a war with a peer or near peer adversary.
Yeah, perfect. James, thank you all very much indeed for that really interesting conversation. I sense this is a conversation that we will have again. There's going to be a lot more to learn from this conflict and others, no doubt, sadly, in the future. So first of all, James and Dylan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Sean, as ever. And thank you to the listener for coming with us on this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.